Accession number 28674, Mr. Richard Corsbrook, Reel 6. Now, what about the officers' mess? Because obviously there'd be a well-established officers'
there
mess.
There was established, well-established, would imply it had been there for years. In this particular case, it couldn't have been there for more than 6-10 months, I suppose. I mean, 12 months. No building, mud and straw construction, mud brick construction, but for all intents and purposes, perfectly reasonable. Things I can only remember was that it was proper mess service. It was tables with some sort of tablecloth, knives and forks. You know, it's all set out properly. The beer was very important, and I remember that the beer was imported from the UK. Can't remember for the life of me at the moment the particular brew, but we got recognisable brews that came from Eindkoop, I think. Eindkoop's, Eindkoop's a name that still exists, but...
Did you drink much?
I don't remember ever getting particularly tight there in Basra. Maybe I was too young, too new to the organisation. But I think we certainly didn't hesitate. We didn't go without. There were other occasions during my time when I certainly had problems getting back to the mess, but that's going on a bit. But there was no great excess. But you know, we just lived a pretty average sort of life out there without any without our families.
Now, remember any incidents that happened while you were at Basra? Any things that happened?
No sort of events that one could comment on, like the ceiling fell in or there was an air, there was a crash, anything, any action. Don't even remember any problems with the locals. We were away from this encampment, not encampment, almost cantonment that was set up. Was basically for the obviously for the troops,
You still weren't getting much contact with them.
Very little contact.
With the Iraqis.
We would go into. No, there is knocking about. For example, our table napkin rings to this day came from a silversmith who had a stall outside Basra, just outside Basra. So we were not in no, except possibly when we get up to Tehran, we were not in the place. We were by it. There was effectively a military camp, permanent camp, set up at Margil, which was to hold the military who were looking after the base and base services.
What's the next thing you remember? What's the next story?
Right, well, we've covered the fact that we went up and down between London, between Basra and Baghdad, enjoying ourselves, either going to Ctesiphon or Kut or Amara. One of the things that happened, all of a sudden, my old regiment or whatever it was, the signals regiment appeared. This would have been in about the middle of two things happened sort of synchronously, actually. I had been, I may have got something slightly out here, but the events happened, but they may be in the wrong sequence. The core signals that I had been with suddenly appeared in Basra to be embarked. They were in to be embarked and going across to India. So the core, it's sort of the progress of the war by the beginning. This was about Stalingrad, the time Stalingrad really got relieved. I mean, there have been not much movement on that front for that particular part of the Eastern Front for months, and that's why we'd come back. But eventually it was pretty obvious that the poor old Germans weren't going to get through the Caucasus. And so the troops that were in Persia and Iraq were sent to India. And lo and behold, the same week that I had got malaria, there was my old section saying, hello, we're just off to India. I mean, just an event. I remember seeing them off on the boat, saying goodbye, and then going into hospital with malaria.
Now, how bad was this malaria attack?
Nothing bad at all. You felt probably no worse than you do these days with a dose of flu, quite literally. But you one felt a bit iffish, a bit woozy. Oh, it's a bit of a temperature. Oh, malaria, bam, you're into hospital. But once you get in the hospital, it was all jolly. You know, a couple of weeks in hospital and you were all right. It wasn't anything dramatic. And the reason I caught malaria, I then got back. I had been on one of our much more extensive jolly, which had gone up into South Persia. And I remember that one night I did not, we were staying in a place called Sultanabad, Arak, A-R-A-K, or Sultanabad. And I didn't put my long sleeve shirt on. And I was bitten. And I got malaria. You know, the right time, and a week later I was back in Basra. Malaria. I mean, it's silly how these things, you don't remember these things. But no, you know, it wasn't in no sense dramatic. It was just a week's holiday, effectively.
What about malaria precautions? Were they? I mean, did you have things to take?
You didn't take pills, no. No, they hadn't got to the... But I seem to think that there was Mepocrine about then. But I don't remember... I think it was very much that all the area was malarial, but not badly so. And so you were not committed. You had to sleep under a mosquito net. And this was almost anywhere. Down in Basra, because it's a swampy old area down there. And we always used a mosquito net down there, but I don't remember using it once we got to Tehran.
So you've got malaria.
I've had malaria. I've got myself my wireless set from Colonel Martin's store, and we are just doing a sort of we're spending as much time as we can out on the road, so to speak. Getting to know the area, quotes. And this takes us through 1943, through 43. Now, Christmas 43, by then we're getting excited. It's getting not exciting. But all sorts of mysterious things at the beginning of December.
What sort of things?
Well, Colonel gets on his bike, so to speak. This was still... Colonel Martin. Yes, it was still Colonel Martin. And disappears to Tehran. Ooh. Tehran conference. And it was Tehran, we didn't go to Tehran. There was some good reason for us not going to Tehran. Nobody went to Tehran. It was not on our beat. We were very much Basra Baghdad. But he, and all got mysterious, because Colonel Martin went up to Tehran. Of course, we realised that the Tehran conference was on. And you know, Colonel Martin had gone and been the telephone operator who had connected Churchill through to Roosevelt. He'd been on the in the switchboard, and when the call came through, and he took it. But that was the sort of miss. That was the great thing in that, because obviously things were beginning to happen, nationally, internationally, as that as well as with us. So we must have spent that Christmas down in. Oh no! Yes, that Christmas I spent in hospital. That was right.
The malaria.
No, I'd had malaria. Oh no, that was yonks ago. I'd caught jaundice, whatever you call it, hepatitis B or whatever you call it now. And this had happened just after the Turin conference, which was, I think, round about the 12th of December. I only know these dates because I've read it all up since. And I felt bloody awful. Went to hospital. You got malaria. Go into hospital.
Jaundice.
And of course, what's the good of having malaria, jaundice at Christmas? You can't drink. Anyway, they starved me of good living over the Christmas. I can't remember what we had for Christmas, but it was this damn, you know, when you get hepatitis, you put on a fat-free diet and all. Not exactly Christmas living. Anyway, somebody said when I came out, and now we're getting through to the new year, 44, we're getting on, aren't we? You've been in hospital, you'd better have a holiday. So, I said, what, can't I go to Tehran then? Because all of a sudden people were quite happy to go to Tehran. So, you go up to, we'll fix for you to go to Tehran. I don't know who did the fixing, but presumably there were contacts through the ordinary staff. So I was given a fortnight's holiday to go to Tehran, a fortnight. Now, going up, to get to Tehran from Basra, you were driven across to Ahwaz, which was a town just in, across the Shat al-Arab, across the river, to Karim Shah, and then the ferry across there. Then you'd drive to Ahwaz, about 90 miles or something, and there you'd catch a train. And I got on this train, more or less run by the Americans, but the Persians were in nominal control. And I got shared a sleeping cabin with an American, who, using the general phrase, plied me with drink on the way up there. So by the time I got to Tehran the next morning, I'd got jaundice again. But I wasn't going to let that stop me, so I had some acquaintance in Tehran, whose name I forget, but who I had known. I think I'd come out on the boat with him. Anyway, he was looking after me. But what cured my jaundice, I maintain, was supper, dinner we had one night in some services club in Tehran, and we had a particularly nice Turkish Persian white wine, and that cured my jaundice immediately. That's my story. But the next morning I was all right. I mean, you know, believe it or not, but and that was my experience of Tehran. I don't remember anything. I remember very little in Tehran on that occasion, because I don't remember what we did, what we saw, but what was there to see in Tehran? Well, not very much. And then back overnight on another train a few days later, I suppose, and back to Basra, normal sort of existence. Then, as an aftermath of the Tehran conference, it probably in no way connected. Our headquarters moved up. Our office moved up to Tehran. And that's an interesting one. I just do not remember how we got there. But the whole office closed.
The whole thing.
Hmm?
The whole the headquarters, or just
the whole of our CSO's office, and I am presuming that a significant general headquarters also moved up there, but it's a complete blank as to how we got there. We probably drove up, must have driven up. Well, I mean, okay, give us a three-ton truck and a couple of 1,500 weights, and the whole of the CSO's office would be mobile. But there obviously was a headquarters went up there, and a picture of the signal office anyway, and we set up a headquarters in a disused or not yet occupied hospital on the northwest corner of Tehran. And again, we did virtually the same job as we had been doing, but obviously doing it from Tehran rather than Basra, and running rather more complicated lines, because by then we had acquired a line route, a trunk line route from Basra to Baghdad via the mountains between Basra and Baghdad, quite a hilly route of about 500 miles, I suppose. Tehran and Baghdad, we're talking about Tehran. And we had a line, we had a connection via the railroad. The Americans ran the railway from Tehran to the south and gave us a pair of wires on their pole route beside the railway down to Basra. So we were connected telephone wires to the south by these two routes. The route to Baghdad went via Kasvin, Kasvin, Hamadan, Kermanshah, Kanakin, Baghdad. Pole route, two pairs, I remember. And they had, for the army, a relatively early carrier system. Am I talking Chinese?
No, it don't make sense, carry on.
A carrier system, which I think was one plus four, one telegraph channel, four speech channels, all the way over the hills from Basra, from Baghdad to Tehran. I presume we had the same down to Basra, but I never remember what that one is. And this, of course, was the route that we periodically had to go and look at, didn't we? And that, where, again, back to my photographs, you have lots of photographs of the line posts we had between Basra and between Tehran. Correction, and the border with Persia at Kanakin, the Persian-Iraq border at Kanakin. Every so often, there was about every 25 miles, round figures, there was a little hut. Again, I always think always describe it as the typical construction there. You know, cow dung, straw, mud bricks. I never remember any imported materials. It would have been, in these days, you'd have imported your breeze blocks and God what. But it was built almost in the style of the area. And in this, there would be accommodation for a crew of linesmen. There'd be about half a dozen to a half a dozen to ten Indian line. They were all Indian troops. There was an Indian signal regiment supplying them. Indian troops who would be looking after their 25, 50 miles of line. So if the line fell down, I mean, obviously they knew when it broke because periodically they tested it by just listening in on the line, and they'd go out and mend it. If you've got a really exciting line post, it would have a carrier repeater in it, and there would be much more exciting because there would be racks of amplifying equipment and a bloody great lead acid battery bank to supply the HT, the LT and HT to the valves. This whole system, this is something that had happened while I was not there or hadn't got there, because this whole system from Basra to, from Tehran to Baghdad had been put in by an itinerant gang of standard telephones engineers. It was a standard STC equipment, who had spent some weeks or some months getting this stuff working, and it was a fascinating story that there was a fait accompli when I got. By the time I got there, it was a bit. I'm a bit sad not to have been in on what was going on, but there was knocking around in Tehran when we were there a standard telephones engineer who was our sort of resident expert on the carrier system that they'd put in. But as I say, if you've got an exciting line post, it had racks of equipment and a large accumulator. Interesting, because as soon as you passed one line post, if you were going up the line or down the line, you would be advised out of one line post to the next one, which is 20 miles or so away. So by the time you got there, the tea would be ready. Standard line, all linesmen, whether Indian, British, Post Office, BT, or Royal Signals, always make tea. They always have to. And I remember it'd be a dry trip. We'd go, nothing particularly difficult about the drive. It was just on a stony dirt road, not tarmac in those days, but a well maintained stone road. You'd be a bit thirsty. We didn't have mobile phones, so you couldn't warn them from a few miles out. They'd be looking out for you, and the tea was there. They're bloody great. And of course, the classic way of making tea was you boil your water in a big belly can, shove in a handful of tea, and then shove in a complete can of condensed milk, and that was the tea we all lived on. That's linesman's tea. Well, that was a typical. We were up and down that line. I say whenever the opportunity presented it, we'd either go up from Basra we'd either go up from Basra through Persia to get to Tehran, in which case we were not following the line route until I don't think we ever followed the line route except along the railway. But in going to Baghdad to Tehran by the road route, we were on our telephone line all the way. While we were in, at some point, hang on, we've misjumped a step. If we must cover the personalities,
I'll go back to that then, yeah.
Yeah, no, while we were in Basra, the CSO changed from Colonel Martin to Potty Watson. Colonel Watson, LRC Watson. They were all great characters, these people.
What were Colonel Martin and Watson like? Both of them, you might as well put them both together. What were the two like as colonels?
Oh, well, Colonel Martin was quite formal. Not rigorously formal, but was a tidy little strict man who needed to be treated with respect. That was none of them, not the sort of spitfire colonel that you imagine, but relatively quiet. Colonel Watson was a benign old gentleman. Well, he was old. He was 45, wasn't he? And he had come from the Cheshire Yeomanry. He was very expansive, would always be talking about his what he had done and where he had been. He'd been in Palestine before the war. And was much more informal. It was much easier to relax with, and that was the whole point. I mean, it was a relaxed life. It wasn't a formal army life at all. It's very difficult to convince anybody that it really wasn't an army life at all. It was a relaxed office life. Anyway, Colonel Watson had come out of the woodwork while we were in Basra, or while we had, it must have been after Christmas, before we moved, because Colonel Martin was there for the Tehran conference, but when we actually moved to Tehran in 43, and I don't remember, 44, I don't remember the date, quite when, it was before D-Day, we'd acquired Colonel Watson. Again, Colonel Watson's is on one of the pictures. We went to Tehran. So eventually we get shifted up to Tehran. We set it up in Tehran. Now this was, of course, at the peak of the aid to Russia.
Tell me a bit about what's going on here.
Aid to Russia. Yes, in retrospect, reading the histories, one wonders, it's never quite acknowledged how much good it did. But Russia, obviously, well, not obviously, actually, because I'm surprised to realise how sensible Russia was in shifting the whole of its manufacturing effort east, as the Germans came in, and they managed to get it well east before the Germans decimated the whole of Russia as far as Stalingrad and the Volga. But there was need for aid to Russia, and one of the routes, apart from the Baltic, which was not a very sanitary one, was to bring stuff in, and of course there was another route, a very dodgy route, over through China. Was to bring stuff in to the ports of the Persian Gulf and cart it up by whatever means. Now that meant that the Americans had come in before I got there, before I got to Basra. But were working it up, and they set up. They took over the railway from South Persia, Ahvaz, to Tehran, but were carrying a lot of stuff up in lorry convoys over the mountains between Basra. Of course, they had to come into Basra. And Tehran, They didn't go via Baghdad. They went up via through Persia all the way, Andamashq, Sultanabad, and up that way. And of course, we had gone out the year or so before. We'd gone out in 1941 originally to kick the Germans or the German influence out of Persia. We went back, we'd stayed there, and then the Americans came in, obviously after Pearl Harbor, and after June 1941, when the Germans invaded Russia. And set up, I don't never knew quite how effective it was. But there were lorry convoys going up all the time by road and by rail.